I'm Kerry Thompson, and if you were wondering what musician best embodied the style of the times exactly 25 years ago, you've downloaded the right podcast.
Michael Jackson's is a style for the 80s. Wet hair, pleated pants, gloves, it's a very sophisticated look.
Yes, sophisticated, but not too far from innocence. Just like us here at Playback, the podcast with absolutely no shame about unearthing stories from the NPR archives. And why would we do this? Well, because they're good stories, and because those kids in the 80s really had it going on. We'll have the backstory on Michael Jackson's Thriller, one of the best-selling albums ever. And in this playback, we feature the lowdown on the pullout of the U.S. Marines in Beirut, Lebanon.
We're definitely not cutting and running. We're reshuffling the deck over there, and one day people will think it's a bold move.
That's David Gergen. We'll hear his take on President Reagan's decision to withdraw U.S. forces in Beirut. And it's a good opportunity to find out, what did people love in the 80s?
What these people love is basic.
Money.
Money.
Life.
What do you love?
How about Tom Cruise?
That too. Yeah.
Food, yeah.
You love lollipops?
Yeah. Lollipops.
Yeah. Rule.
Yeah, they rule. Or they ruled in February 84, according to well-placed sources here at Playback. So, let's pretend you're a prominent politician, the first African-American to run for president. You're facing an uphill battle in the New Hampshire primary. You've just said something really unfortunate, and your name is...
The Reverend Jesse Jackson. Jackson's campaign had been plagued for more than a week by well-publicized reports that the candidate had, in private conversations, referred to Jews as Jaimes and to New York City as Jaime Town. At first, he denied the charges, but according to NPR's Linda Wertheimer, Jackson moved last night to set the record straight.
Jesse Jackson went to a synagogue here in Manchester, New Hampshire. It was an appearance that the Brotherhood of the synagogue had asked him to make some time ago, and he had agreed that the campaign would send some kind of a surrogate speaker to talk to them. But yesterday, he decided to come himself, and he used the occasion to apologize for a racist remark, which he said he did make, but and which was overheard by a reporter and then reported. He very carefully couched the whole thing, saying that he was very sorry that it had happened and that it was an insensitive thing. But he insisted that he meant no racial slur by it and that he would never have said it in any kind of context of racial slur.
Slur or no slur, Jackson still lives in the shadow of that remark. And some think it led to an enduring split between Jackson and many Jewish people. And on the last day of February 1984, the voters of New Hampshire had their say.
A stunning upset in New Hampshire tonight, Colorado Senator Gary Hart has taken the first Democratic primary of the 84 campaign.
Many people thought, including the front runner, that this campaign would be over tonight. This campaign just begins tonight.
While Senator Gary Hart is savoring victory this evening, Walter Mondale says he is looking forward to tomorrow. And it appears that a combination of bad northeastern weather and a rising tide of momentum from the Iowa caucuses helped give Hart a decisive win in New Hampshire's presidential primary today. NPR's Linda Wertheimer is standing by at Tabulation Central in Manchester, New Hampshire. Linda, what do the numbers look like?
New Hampshire's Democrats who went through the polls through all that snow and slush today, apparently quite a few Democrats didn't make it at all. The turnout in the state is a little more than half what it was in 1980. About 70% of the precincts are reporting now. And Senator Gary Hart of Colorado is the clear winner, but he only has about 17,000 votes. That's 39% of all the vote cast. Former Vice President Walter Mondale is second with a little more than 12,000 votes. That's 28%. Senator John Glenn of Ohio is running third. He has nearly 12% of the vote. And next is the Reverend Jesse Jackson with almost 6. Then former Senator George McGovern with just about the same number of voters.
Now, I don't want to be a spoiler for the results of the 84 presidential election, but let's just say things didn't end up going Gary Hart's way, or the Democrats' way, for that matter. And if you're thinking it was because of what became known as the Monkey Business Affair... Monkey Business being the name of the boat Hart was photographed in front of with a 29-year-old, not his wife, on his lap. That didn't happen until the next election cycle, 1988. Here's a predicament that might sound eerily familiar. The Reagan administration was trying to figure out whether or not to keep U.S. troops in Beirut, Lebanon. It was an unsustainable situation for many. After the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut in October 83, when 241 Americans lost their lives. The Marines had arrived as part of an international peacekeeping force in 1982, and though President Reagan was initially defiant, he announced his decision in February of 84.
A senior administration official said yesterday that the first phase of the redeployment would be completed within a month, and would involve about 500 of the 1,200 to 1,500 Marines now stationed at the Beirut airport. He said that eventually the administration intends to redeploy most of the Marines in Beirut, but some will stay behind to provide security for the U.S. Embassy and the ambassador, and others will stay to train the Lebanese army. The president's statement said that even before the latest round of violence, the administration had been considering ways of reconcentrating our forces in order to take the initiative away from the terrorists, although the administration has been critical of congressional suggestions that it do essentially what it has now done. In any event, the U.S. Marines will be moved to the relative safety of naval ships, and that eliminates one risk for the U.S. and the Reagan administration.
David Gergen, yes, that David Gergen, the political pundit on cable news, was a speechwriter in the Reagan White House until he left his post in 84. He offered up this viewpoint.
If you're confused today about just what the United States is trying to accomplish in Lebanon, don't worry. You have plenty of company. Watching television news last night, one heard again and again that the withdrawal of the Marines from Beirut means we are leaving the mess in Lebanon once and for all. Members of Congress rushed to the microphones to proclaim the announcement. Many commentators said this was essentially a domestic political decision, and now President Reagan has removed the last obstacle to his reelection. A few observers dared to ask, and it's a good question, whether such a retreat might be good politics at home, but ultimately leave the United States with fewer friends and less credibility overseas. So, we're ringing down the curtain in Lebanon, right? Or at least that's what you may have thought when you nodded off to sleep last night. But hold on, it seems there's more to the story. Waking up this morning, one finds the New York Times blazing with front page headlines. Quote, Reagan widens air and sea role. His new policy, the headlines say, quote, may lead to deeper U.S. involvement. And sure enough, today, the huge 16-inch guns on the New Jersey lobbed more than 100 rounds into the Beirut area. Smaller guns, the 5-inchers on Navy ships, poured in over 300 rounds on Syrian positions. No doubt, cynics will quickly jump to the conclusion that the naval gunfire is only a fig leaf, a disguise for a new cut-and-run policy by the United States. But at a time of confusion, there's an old rule that serves well. Listen before you leap. Our government, for the past 24 hours, has been trying to tell us something important. It may not have been said artfully. There could have been better timing for the announcement, but the administration has been plainly saying that the shift of the Marines does not mean we're leaving Lebanon. As a leading foreign policy advisor in our government told me this afternoon, we're definitely not cutting and running. We're reshuffling the deck over there, and one day people will think it's a bold move. Well, we all need to wait and see who's right, whether we're leaving or actually staying. Personally, I find those big 16-inch guns on the New Jersey make a rather convincing argument. In the meantime, perhaps we could lower our voices here at home and keep this out of Campaign 84 for a while. This is a moment when the country, whether led by a Republican or Democrat, needs to speak with one voice and act with single resolve. There will be plenty of time later on to assign blame or credit, as the case may be.
Commentator David Gergen. And since we've had 25 years to assign blame or credit, I guess we'll go with the credit scenario. The pullout of U.S. forces in Beirut was widely regarded as a smart move by the Reagan administration, and it bolstered Reagan's popularity in his bid for re-election that fall. And speaking of popular dudes, here's a guy who fits the bill.
Music from the hottest-selling album in America, Michael Jackson's Thriller. The album has sold more than 25 million copies. Jackson, age 25, has been nominated in as many categories. From Los Angeles, Steve Proffitt has this report on pop music's hottest property.
Outside Michael Jackson's house in Encino, California, a small group of fans are waiting for a glimpse of their hero. I'm waiting too because, by all accounts, Michael Jackson is a very shy person, and he doesn't grant interviews to the press. So I'm waiting here with the fans.
He'll come to his gate, he'll talk to people, or he'll stand right there and he'll wave to you at least. And a lot of people don't do that.
Ever since Elvis Presley, every major pop star has set a style, and Michael Jackson's is a style for the 80s. Wet hair, pleated pants, gloves, it's a very sophisticated look. But Michael lives here with his mother in this rather modest mansion. He says he's never used drugs, he doesn't drink or smoke, and he is a devout Jehovah's Witness. This very atypical pop star has somehow fascinated America.
We haven't had a popular culture figure who could dance in an awfully long time.
Nelson George is a writer for Billboard magazine and the author of a biography on our subject, The Michael Jackson Story. He often likens Jackson to the young Elvis Presley.
Elvis danced, and part of Elvis's appeal and part of his threat to America at the time was that pelvis gyration and the fact that he moved so seductively. And it's something about a guy who can move dance that just drives people crazy. It adds a whole nother level to the excitement of his singing. She says,
it was this song, Billie Jean, that was the flashpoint in Jackson's career. In May of last year, he performed it on a televised tribute to Motown that featured some of that label's biggest talent.
Marvin Gaye was very good that night. I thought he was quite remarkable. The Temptations and the Four Tops were a lot of fun. But when you got right down to it, everyone remembered the next day Michael Jackson. It's really something for a young black guy from Gary, Indiana to reach that far.
As the lead singer for the Jackson 5, Michael was a star before he was 12. He and his brothers were the leading exponents of a musical style called bubblegum and sold more than 100 million records. In 1979, Michael released a critically acclaimed solo album, Off the Wall. It produced four hit singles, but many of the AOR, adult-oriented rock stations, would not play Jackson's music.
Michael, with that album, was stifled by the same thing that stifled so many black artists, since Hendrix, I guess. And that they haven't been able to get play on that on the AOR and reach the mainstream white male rock audience.
So for his next album, Thriller, Michael engineered a self-transformation in both his image and his music. To attract white audiences, he hired heavy metal guitarist Eddie Van Halen to play on one song, Beat It, and he made drastic changes in his personal appearance.
He got rid of the tuxedo and the little flashing socks. He had these leather jackets. They were like two sizes too big. He had the hair done. He had the face done. He made a very conscious effort to mold his image and mold his look to be as appealing as possible. And I think it was it's obviously very conscious and obviously very successful.
So far, Thriller has produced six hit singles and, more importantly, three videos. With his new look and a big push from CBS, his record company, Michael broke a fairly tight barrier, becoming the first black act to run on MTV, the cable music video service. Michael Gilmore, a rock critic for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, says Jackson has been able to unite white and black audiences, and he says that not since the Beatles has one act so dominated pop music.
This year, there seems to be more consensus between public opinion and industry opinion, critical opinion, than at any time I can remember. People clearly seem to recognize Jackson as the leading figure of the moment.
But because of his immense popularity and his private nature, he is the subject of intense curiosity. His androgynous look, the voice, the peach-fuzzed face, the flamboyant outfits have caused some to speculate about his sexuality. Critic Michael Gilmore.
He strikes me as a very masculine performer and as a masculine singer. High voices are a very old and lively tradition in black popular music and in much of white popular music, too. I don't think he makes a conscious use of that in an effeminate way, and I think his music is backed up by so much force and muscularity that I think he sort of negates the issue in a way. You wanna be tough, better
do what you can, so beat it. Finally, there is Jackson's career as a film actor. He was featured in the movie The Wiz, and now there's talk of a remake of Peter Pan, starring Michael Jackson as the boy who wouldn't grow up, directed by Steven Spielberg. Meanwhile, outside the Jackson home, the fans continue their vigil.
There's no one in this world like him. There's never been, and there probably never will be. I'd be really surprised if it was.
What do you want to happen? Do you just want him to say hi to you, or just to catch his eye, or...
Be friends. We want to be friends with him. And I'm sure we will be.
But as the sun goes down, even these most dedicated of devotees begin to lose their patience.
He's not coming out. He's
there? Yeah. Well, he hasn't yet.
Better.
He just went in.
For National Public Radio in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Proffitt.
Well, anyway, I'm going to his door because I'm going to buy him a card. This is thanks for being nice to all of us. Yeah, I'm going to his door right now.
Okay.
For more stories about the hottest acts, musical acts, that is, go to nprmusic.org. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback. Okay, now I have to admit, this next piece is really odd. I mean, even by my relaxed standards, but I really like it, and I think it's informative. And yes, this aired on NPR. Here's producer Dee Roberts.
What do you like most about Mitt?
I like the idea that they're different than I am.
Their personalities, I guess. What attracts you most to men?
I usually like a tall man, but men are not generic, so I like a good personality and a good sense of humor.
Aggressiveness and their out there-ness. Sometimes they're funny and stuff, I guess.
What's the best feature about them?
Their eyes. I like their eyes. And the muscles, too.
And I like their shoulders.
If he's got money?
Interesting looking, but not necessarily macho looking.
I don't care.
I like only a particular kind of man. I like men with mustaches because I like to kiss men with mustaches so that I can get my nose clean at the same time.
I like how they carry on. I think they're attractive.
Why do you like men? What do you like most about men?
What do you like most about men?
About men.
Why I like men.
For one thing, there's their big muscles. But I know that's not everything. And some guys don't even have any. Which allows them to pursue their other interests, such as computer technology or male bonding.
Second and 11. Roar the running back behind Tunnicliffe.
The best has a taste all its own.
One thing they tend to like is beer. The other thing is cars, for which I don't blame them. They like things that are on fire and loud noises, which has led to problems more than once. Some have tried to make up for it by writing a folk song.
Where have all the flowers...
Where have all the flowers gone, for example? I cannot help the fact that I like to kiss them. For life is filled with such mysteries. Kiss.
You got to not talk dirty, baby. Okay, I told you it was funny and weird. A good example of a story that probably wouldn't have made it to air today. The same is true for this next story about love. Here's Man About Town, our February 84 reporter extraordinaire, Steve Proffitt. He was tasked with finding out who do you love, what do you love, and where do you love. He talked to Bob Edwards.
Now, Steve, we know it was a tough assignment, but today's the day. So what did you come up with?
Well, Bob, to answer question number one, who do you love, we first turn to an expert, Stephen Levitt of TV Performance, a Long Island, New York firm that compiles something called Q ratings. Mr. Levitt's firm questions people about thousands of celebrities and assigns each a Q rating.
It represents the degree to which people that know about a particular personality or celebrity have a feeling of enthusiasm towards that personality.
Okay, so according to TV performance, these are the people America loves.
The most popular was Alan Alda, followed by Carol Burnett, Harry Morgan, Tom Selleck, Mike Farrell, Katharine Hepburn, Bob Hope, Paul Newman, George Burns, Clint Eastwood.
Now, Bob, I knew you wouldn't be content with such pat answers, so I did a little survey of my own. Last Saturday, I rode over to Melrose Avenue. That's in L.A., just south of Hollywood. It's an area full of trendy shops selling the latest in punk fashions. It's a place where lots of average, normal Angelenos spend an afternoon. So I asked the same question. Who do you love most?
I love my husband, of course.
The children.
My kitty cat.
The grandchildren.
Women.
Oh, God.
Lots and lots of women.
Myself, I think. That's it. Myself.
I would love the fact that everybody could live together peacefully, but right now that's not possible.
My grandmother. I love my grandmother.
I'm looking. If anybody out there...
who do you love?
Judy. I love her very much, and I'm sorry that we couldn't go to the movies today, but I'll make it up to her next weekend.
Okay, question number two. What do you love? Well, for this question, we chose as our expert Terry Richman. She's the owner of the International Love Boutique. Ms. Richman is also the creator of a line of sensual emollients, which she calls emotion lotion.
Those are our most popular products because they use it up and keep coming back for more. We're now making emotion lotion in 14 different flavors.
Ms. Richman claims every day is Valentine's Day at the International Love Boutique, and she says what people love most are her, well, unusual fashions.
We have all kinds of exciting lingerie, you know, with hearts on it, and both for men and for the ladies.
However, Bob, back out on Melrose, I couldn't find a single male or female who told me what they really loved was a bright red lacy teddy. No, Bob, what these people love is more basic.
Money.
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 Yeah.
Money.
Life.
What do you love?
Birds.
Birds, huh? How about Tom Cruise?
That too.
Yeah.
I love life most.
I love beer.
Oh.
I love beer.
I love beer too.
Ice cream.
Food, yeah.
You love lollipops?
Yeah. Lollipops.
Yeah. Rule.
Open fields of grass, nothing but grass, just fields of, you know, grass, no trees or anything.
Not much grass around here.
No, I know.
Culture clubs.
Sex, drugs, rock and roll.
I love Saturday nights in West Hollywood. I love going to the Greenery for coffee and chili fries.
Chili
fries. I like to eat. I love to eat. I love to sleep. I love to have a good time.
Now, question number three. Where do these people do their loving? Well, our expert Terry Richman says...
The back of the car, especially if they have a van.
And Lieutenant Dan Cook of the Los Angeles Police Department agrees that Angelenos' love affairs with their cars often lead to love affairs in their cars.
The van is a major problem, and of course you have all year pretty good weather. And that's another thing, you know, you don't find people out there in the freezing blizzards of Montana trying to do a thing like this. They'll go to someone's home, or if they go at all, I suppose. I don't know what they're doing.
So what about our normal people out there on Melrose? Well, Bob, I took a deep breath and I asked question number three. Where do you love to make love?
Are you sure this is for public radio? Come on.
Usually in a bed. Usually. That's where it is, usually.
Toss up between the living room and the bedroom.
On the kitchen floor.
Linoleum floor or...
Yeah. Yeah.
Usually in a house. Not necessarily in the bedroom, but in a house.
Well... I don't consider making love. It's creating. It's an art. Period.
Period. Question number four. Who was your best lover? Well, Bob, I tried to get an expert for this one, but Zsa Zsa Gabor just wouldn't return my phone call, so once again, it's back to the streets.
Who is my best lover? A girl from Berlin.
What made her special?
She was older and knew what she was doing.
My husband. I don't have any other.
My boyfriend. I only have one lover.
Your current?
Mm-hmm.
And how about you?
None of your business.
Who was my best lover? Well, that's a hard one. What time is it? That's personal, in fact. Is this thing really on?
Yeah, it's on. It's
oh, wow, that's terrific.
The first guy I ever fell in love with. Maybe. Hopefully it'll get better.
Well, Bob, you asked for it. and that's the way it is. In Los Angeles, for National Public Radio, I'm Steve Proffitt.
Time goes by so slowly, and time can do so much.
Now, to prevent you from thinking you are totally hallucinating, we have this nice, fairly normal chat with singer-songwriter Steve Goodman. He's legendary in Chicago for the song Go Cubs Go and for the city of New Orleans. He talked with NPR's Noah Adams.
The people I study in this business are folks that have been doing this for just an age. Jethro Burns, the great mandolin player, he's been doing this for 52 years. Count Basie is almost 80 years old, and he can barely walk. But still, every now and then, there's a 50-city Count Basie tour. And Ella Fitzgerald, you know, I mean, I don't for a moment think that I could ever be in class with any of these musicians, but they're my heroes, Pete Seeger as well. And I just don't think that there's a way I could get out of a musical life. You know, those are my ambitions. I don't know, I have long-term goals. I'd like to be doing this when they come and take me away, you know. I have a song about Carl Martin, right, who's a member of Martin Bogan and the Armstrongs. And Carl's gone now. He died in 1979, but they were a group that played together on and off for almost 60 years. Carl Martin was sort of like a grandfather to me. I think anybody who does what I do for a living can look back and say, well, this is one of the guys that taught me how to play. And in my case, it was Carl. You know, Carl always had a way to make the good times roll when the rest of us weren't so sure. He'd just pick out the prettiest woman in the room, and then he'd sing every song to her. Well, you know, one night back east when the gig was done, there was this all-night blowout jam. We kept drinking and singing and playing and drinking and singing some more until the sun came up again. There was blues and ballads, and ragtime, Dixieland swing, old-time show tunes, and then Carl sang a couple of songs no one had ever heard, and some I haven't heard since then. And right before dawn, they played two more songs just to separate the strong from the faint. It was a red-hot rendition of The Old Pine Tree and a double-time version of The Saints. And when those were done, those of us who could still breathe took off our hats to that man. Carl played everybody under the table that night. He said, you better get it while you can. You know, Carl and his band never got too far. When he died, Martin didn't have a dime. He was a little behind in his payments and a little bit ahead of his time. Now last week, me and some of us so-called musicians sat up real late and burned one down. The liquor kept coming, and we kept strumming till a minute or two before the dawn. There were some that stayed and some that faded, and soon I was left all alone. I don't believe in ghosts, but I could swear I heard Carl Martin singing one more song. It went, you better get it while you can. Better get it while you can. If you wait too long, that'll all be gone. You'll be sorry then. No matter if you're rich or poor, it's the same for a woman or a man. From the cradle to the crypt is a mighty short trip, so you better get it while you can.
And now, sadly, late singer-songwriter Steve Goodman, who passed away later that year in September of 84. And thanks for getting it while you could here at Playback. On behalf of the Playback production team, Mr. Michael the Cat Katziff, Mr. Robert Lespierre, and all the NPR librarians who have to deal with me every month, like clockwork. Next month, it'll be March 84. We'll have an interview with actor John Malkovich, and the term yuppie is born. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.